WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, volunteer-operated radio. My name is Paul Muth. This is Window on the World. No, that's tomorrow. I do a show that's more internationally focused. And I'll be trying to get to some of the alternative media coverage of the attack on Gaza, the melee in the streets, the ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem and other environs, and the U.S. reaction. I've got a little segment from Democracy Now, just a little excerpt that includes Rashid Holiday's response to a Biden quote from 86. I think it came out of Jeremy Scahill's Empire Politician project, going through almost everything that was recorded or written by Biden through his long career, and found a very salient one. Holiday was a neighbor of then State Senator Barack Obama. They were friendly. In fact, Republicans did use his friendship with Holiday as a campaign against him various times. After Edward Said's death, I guess Holiday became the professor of terror, as they called Said for so many years. Amy Goodman's got something on voting rights. She did great work through on the Middle East through the week. But main focus is another project of Scahill's, and that's about, what shall we say, Big Pharma, the Dole Buy Bill. It's the only place that I've heard mentioned marching rights, part of the Dole Buy. Gosh, I'm glad that turned itself off because I'm kind of flying low here today. I couldn't figure out what it was. I Googled it a number of times. There's very little reported. They do explain it a little bit, don't dwell on it, but basically the Dole Buy Amendment signed by Carter in that era was neoliberalism writ large. It was supposedly to solve a problem that academic and NIH research wasn't being brought to the people, and that we needed the corporate influence to do that. I've been talking about killer acquisitions today. Now what corporations do is they buy promising treatments and they put them on cold storage, killer acquisitions. It's done in a lot of fields. In fact, ventilators were handled that way by the major manufacturer of ventilating systems. When a government contract to fill the supplies of that, it's a really grim story, of which there are many, I'm afraid. The reporting from The Intercept includes Li Fang and a woman whose name I can't remember, both quite well spoken. They leave some things out. Like I said, there's very little in the press, just Google marching rights definition. I got a link, in fact, the first link, because I guess it's a vagary of the dearth of hits, that my first hit was an article about State Senator Durkin weaponizing anti-Semitism, the bill that proposes a bill, or maybe it's already existing, that links anti-Zionism to anti-Semitism and would implement it at the state level. It's already somewhat implemented, but this would codify it even more. Since it already does exist, it's really kind of a showboat. It's kind of a political tactic, but it was an odd way to find out about it. I was researching the Buy-Dole bill that would... Actually, the bill does privatize all these research projects, but it would allow the government to say, hey, we paid for all of this. You have to license it to somebody else, because you're not making enough of it. That's already in the law. You don't have to wait for the World Health Organization or the WTO TRIPS item. Anyway, that's a long preamble, but that kind of covers Oh, except last minute I exchanged something. I was going to play some web exclusive that Amy Goodman did on Israel-Palestine conflagration. But Walden Bellow, who I was lucky enough to meet here on campus once, is interviewed by Sonali Kalantar about the myth that there is no capacity in the third lesser developed countries to produce material to help save all of us, actually. All right, here's Mumi Abu-Jamal. He's in good voice. I'm waiting to hear what he's going to say about MOVE, the discovery of these bones being used in an academic environment, the children of the MOVE conflagration, where a whole neighborhood in Philly was burnt down. Mumia was a friend of MOVE. I don't think he lived there. But the interviews I've heard with the MOVE people are all call for Mumia to be set free. Also wondering what he'll say about Philly DA. Larry Krasner was elected. He was slow in allowing a retrial, which Mumia is in fiddle for now, apparently. All right, here's Mumia's commentary. It's well, he explains.
I don't usually do this. This is discuss myself. I find it far more interesting to tell the stories of others, the revolving globe on which we dwell, and the stories spawned by the fragile human condition and the struggles of humanity for liberation. But I digress. Uncomfortably, this commentary is about the commentator. Several weeks ago, I underwent a medical procedure known as open heart surgery, a double bypass, after it was learned that two vessels leading to my heart had significant blockages that impaired heart function. This impairment was fixed by extremely well-trained and young cardiologists who had extensive experience in this intricate surgical procedure. I tell you, I had no clue whatsoever that I suffered from such disease. Now, to be perfectly honest, I feel fine. Indeed, I feel more energetic than usual. I thank you, all my family and friends, for your love and support. Onwards to freedom, with all my heart, from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
And they have a lot of people contributing material to prisonradio.org. You can get an update on Mumia there generally. Links to his story. Last week in my absence, there was an interview with Janice Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the program Counterspin, where she went through how historically how it was characterized. Okay. Got it all the way maxed out, and I'm hearing weird audio. So why don't we get to the next segment? Let's see if I can figure this out. I have a feeling maybe not. Here's Amy with breaking the sound barrier on voting rights.
Voter suppression, the Republican war on facts, snacks, and democracy. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The January 6th insurrection was one way to try to overthrow democracy, incite a mob to ransack the Capitol, and threaten to kill key leaders who dared renounce Donald Trump's big lie that Joe Biden stole the 2020 election. People were killed and injured. Public property was damaged. But Congress still counted the Electoral College votes, delayed by only about 12 hours. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland called the insurrection the most dangerous threat to democracy he has witnessed.
And in the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat we face comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocate for the superiority of the white race.
Now a more sophisticated effort to subvert democracy is underway. Across the country, voter suppression bills are being rushed through Republican-controlled state legislatures. These, coupled with partisan gerrymandering that will follow the 2020 U.S. Census results, could erase a century and a half of struggle and progress for voter rights in this country, potentially allowing permanent control of our government by a white supremacist minority. The Brennan Center for Justice has been tracking these bills, and as of April 1st, had counted an astounding 361 of them in 47 states. Georgia and Arizona have already enacted significant voter suppression laws. Both states were Republican strongholds for decades. In 2020, Joe Biden won them both, as did Democratic Senate candidates Mark Kelly in Arizona and John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in Georgia. Biden's win in those states and the loss of those three Senate seats, and thus control of the U.S. Senate, was a devastating defeat for the Republican Party. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, reacted on the Fox News channel shortly after the election, saying,
"If Republicans don't challenge and change the U.S. election system, there'll never be another Republican president elected again."
Republicans have heeded Graham's warning, flooding the country with strikingly similar bills designed to restrict and deter voting with the help of the right-wing group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
That's the late conservative activist Paul Weyrich in 1980, articulating a long-standing tenet of GOP electoral strategy. This is Mother Jones journalist Ari Berman, the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The issue is not Democrats versus Republicans. The issue is Republicans versus democracy. They're making it harder for everybody to vote.
The bills target traditionally Democratic voters, primarily in communities of color and urban centers, through a range of tactics, from purging voter rolls and felon disenfranchisement to strict requirements for photo identification, imposing voter registration barriers, making drastic cuts to early absentee and mail-in voting, and reducing or eliminating curbside voting, ballot drop box locations, and the number and capacity of polling places. There's also a concerted effort to bring back the Jim Crow era tactic of aggressive voter intimidation by partisan so-called poll watchers. In Arizona, Republican Governor Doug Ducey just signed a bill that could purge over 100,000 voters from the early mail-in voting list. In Georgia, even more voters were purged prior to the 2018 election, purged by the Republican candidate for governor, Brian Kemp, who was then Secretary of State, overseeing the very election he would later narrowly win. Senator Raphael Warnock, in his first floor speech as a U.S. senator, said,
"I hail from a state that purged 200,000 voters from the roll one Saturday night in the middle of the night. We know what's happening here. Some people don't want some people to vote."
Georgia's new draconian so-called election integrity law delivered a slew of voter suppression methods, even criminalizing giving food or water to people waiting in line to vote. Florida enacted its voter suppression law, including the ban on providing voters with snacks and water. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis angered Florida news broadcasters by giving an exclusive live interview to Fox and Friends, reportedly Trump's favorite program, as he signed the bill into law. News of democracy's death may be greatly exaggerated, however, as grassroots activism to protect the right to vote gathers momentum. Public Citizen, Common Cause, Black Voters Matter, Indivisible, and other groups are pushing Congress to pass historic pro-democracy legislation this year. H.R. 1-S1, the For the People Act, would restore and expand the protections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, gutted by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision in 2013. It would immediately render most of these voter suppression bills illegal. Massive public pressure will be needed to get the For the People Act through the Senate. As the late voting rights icon, Congressmember John Lewis wrote in his final essay published last summer on the day of his funeral, quote, "Democracy is not a state. It's an act, and each generation must do its part by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble," John Lewis wrote. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That's the motto I share. Get in the right kind of trouble. Okay, I'm in a little trouble to get everything I've storyboarded out for you on the air, so I'm going to go right to it. I guess it was just my headphones were really loud and it was doing something weird to me, though. I promised that I'd get to kind of a roundup, hopefully, of coverage of the crisis in Israel-Palestine tomorrow, but Amy Goodman had a lot of great stuff on it, and this excerpt was particularly amazing. Again, he was a colleague, friend, neighbor of Barack Obama when Obama was state senator, and I'm sure it was pretty torturous for him. If you remember, there was a mowing the lawn episode in Gaza after his election, before his inauguration, if I'm recalling correctly. All right. And I guess Holliday did campaign for him. Maybe he was asked not to, since, again, he was called Professor of Terror, appellation also given to Edward Said in his day. Here's a short segment from Thursday, is it?
We look at the Middle East. I think it's about time we stop, those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel.
That was Senator Biden in 1986. Has he changed his view? And talk about what he is saying, Professor Holliday.
Well, what he's saying is that Israel operates as a proxy of the United States in the Middle East. And what he's also saying is, vote for me and continue to give me campaign donations. That's unspoken. And those two elements in support for Israel, both in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party, have been constants. The search for a strategic role for Israel sometimes has gotten pretty desperate, because Israel, in fact, harms American interests in many cases in the Middle East. But the pretext, which during the Cold War, Biden was speaking in 86 at the very end of the Cold War. During the Cold War, it could be argued, well, Israel was an American proxy and there were Soviet proxies and so on. Those feeble pretexts for arguing for a strategic role for Israel as benefiting the United States, those have disappeared since the Cold War. Since then, unfortunately, the so-called war on terror has taken the place of that. And Israel has managed to merge into American concerns that were sparked by the 9/11 attacks and the rise of the Islamic State and so forth in order to sell itself to Americans. Netanyahu was a master salesman in this regard, as a valuable ally in the war on terror. In fact, American support for Israel probably provokes a lot of terrorism. Israeli actions, we know, provoke resistance. Colonial settler regimes always provoke resistance. If you dispossess people, they're going to resist. Native Americans did the same thing. Africans facing settler colonialism did the same thing. Palestinians have resisted. And this resistance, coded as terrorism, is then turned into a pretext for arguing that Israel is vital to American interests. Well, if you did not have this settler colonial process of dispossession, which has been going on since 1948, you would not have the resistance, and you would not have what is being called terrorism by American politicians.
Rashid Holliday, formerly UC, I believe, and now at Columbia. I guess I gave a disclaimer at the beginning. So it's an instrumental use of Israel. It's not foreign of itself. I guess I'm beating it. It's not something you hear in commentary. All right, now to the COVID crisis. And the Bayh-Dole sounds really absurd, but I mentioned a little about the march-in rights. Did I say that it's a man from the government is here? He's marching in. That's apparently the idiom. It's why the lobbyists control the language, I guess, because that sounds insidious. When you would say that, well, the government paid for all of this research that you're benefiting from, and you're not... you aren't cooperative in getting it to the people that need it. Let's see about licensing it even, which we're down to their profits. But anyway.
This is Intercepted.
I'm Laura Flynn, supervising producer at The Intercept. At this point in the U.S., more than 50% of people have received at least one COVID-19 vaccine shot. While there are still hotspots in some parts of the country, the overall number of new infections and deaths are precipitously declining. After a fall and winter surge in hospitalizations and deaths in Los Angeles County, the region is now on track to vaccinate 80% of adults by the end of July. On Monday, the Food and Drug Administration authorized the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds, further expanding vaccine access in the U.S. However, worldwide infection rates are still rising in 30 countries. India and Brazil are reporting the most new infections each day. India has reported consecutive daily death tolls above 4,000 as hospitals run out of oxygen, beds, and life-saving drugs.
This morning, India's healthcare system is completely overwhelmed as the country grapples with the world's largest COVID crisis.
India's daily COVID-19 death toll has hit a record high, with more than 4,000 people succumbing to the virus in a single day. 4,187 deaths have been confirmed in the past 24 hours.
This second wave of the coronavirus in India has also been breaking records for new infections. But scientists say the country's official numbers are almost certainly a vast undercount.
From the beginning of the pandemic, Intercept investigative journalists Sharon Lerner and Lee Fong have reported on how efforts to maintain intellectual property rights, from life-saving drugs to vaccines, have hindered the global response. I spoke to them about the need for a global warp speed.
Just as soon as COVID was coming down the pike and people around the world started realizing that we were heading into a true pandemic, the major pharmaceutical companies began gearing up to profit from that pandemic.
It's been clear that a relatively small but very influential number of leaders on Wall Street, people who represent investors, have seen this as a golden opportunity.
I'm Sharon Lerner. I'm an investigative reporter at The Intercept. I've been covering vaccine and COVID-related profiteering since the beginning of the pandemic.
I'm Lee Fong. I'm an investigative reporter for The Intercept. I cover the confluence of money and politics. And like Sharon, I've been writing a lot about some of the corruption issues, some of the inequality issues that have arisen out of this pandemic.
Are you going to back the waiver of the WTO? Are you going to back that? Is the U.S. government
going to back that? Yes, I'm talking about that today, yes.
So the big news last week is that Katherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative, issued a statement saying that the Biden administration is now supporting waiving IP protections for vaccines.
The Biden administration surprised a lot of observers by coming out in favor of this waiver proposed last year by a coalition of countries led by India and South Africa, asking for a temporary suspension of IP and patent enforcement on certain medications related to the COVID-19 pandemic, basically saying that corporations that own the IP or patent rights to vaccines, to therapeutics, to other medical treatments, there should be no enforcement so that other countries can allow their homegrown industries, their pharmaceutical companies, to produce generic vaccines and other medical products to end the pandemic as fast as possible.
The Trump administration, not surprisingly, was against this, along with Brazil, the EU, Australia, several other countries that were opposing the TRIPS waiver. The basic importance of this waiver, which is only supposed to last during the pandemic, is that it can free up companies to make vaccines. And obviously, we still need that. The vast majority of the world isn't vaccinated, particularly the low-income countries where less than 1% of the population has been vaccinated.
Right now, the way that wealthier countries, the U.S. and others, are confronting this crisis for the developing world is through voluntary agreements. The largest of such is an organization called COVAX. That's kind of an initiative chartered from a nonprofit founded by the Gates Foundation, by Bill Gates, called Gavi. It's also sanctioned through the World Health Organization.
The COVAX pillar aims to ensure that every country gets fair and equitable access to eventual COVID-19 vaccines. It does this by acting as an insurance policy with the largest portfolio of vaccine candidates in the world. Wealthier countries.
Basically, this is a voluntary effort where wealthier countries can donate their excess vaccines. Wealthy individuals and corporations can make donations to this group to make purchases of vaccines, and then those vaccines can be distributed on a not-for-profit or free basis to the developing world. And that's been kind of the international effort. And so far, it's kind of fallen short.
So right now, COVAX has delivered about 54 million doses, which is way better than not delivering 54 million doses, but it's nowhere near what the world needs. And their goal is really to reach some of it. It's not even designed to reach everybody.
And it relies just simply on pharmaceutical companies cutting their own voluntary agreements with each country through COVAX or wealthier countries making voluntary donations. It can't force, you know, the transfer of vaccines. It can't allow the transfer of technology to produce generics. It's really just kind of a gigantic charity effort that, although well-intentioned, has come incredibly short in terms of ending the pandemic. And that's where we're at today, a question of, do we continue the approach led by COVAX in getting the vaccine to the developing world, or do we try some new approaches? That's where the waiver comes in. Do we start leapfrogging the demands of these pharmaceutical companies and sharing the technology, sharing the formulas, getting more capacity out there so there can be more competition in this market and more vaccines to developing countries?
The head of the WHO tweeted that it was a monumental moment in the fight against COVID. It really is. Almost immediately, you saw the stock prices of vaccine makers tumble.
Vaccine makers taking a hit in the last hour of trading after the Biden administration said it supports waiving patent protections for COVID vaccines. That would effectively hand over the secret recipe for these life-saving vaccines to other manufacturers, possibly in other countries, to make them. Shares of Pfizer, Moderna, Novavax.
Moderna, Novavax, Pfizer, even the Chinese vaccine makers, their prices just started to fall. And you saw industry begin to freak out.
Bio, which is a trade group that represents Moderna, Pfizer, and other large pharmaceutical companies, claimed that this decision will act, quote, as a disincentive for companies to respond to the next pandemic. They've claimed that this is an unprecedented step that will decrease the ability for pharmaceutical companies to create innovative products in the future.
And then they got even uglier, and they started warning that this is going to undermine the global response to the pandemic and that it's dangerous. And this is echoing these arguments that the pharmaceutical industry has been making from the beginning about this, that it will destroy the intellectual property system, it's going to discourage innovation, and it's really dangerous because other countries and other companies don't have the capacity to do this safely.
There are really two ways to combat this crisis. There's a way to do it in a sense that maximizes profit for the healthcare companies, the pharmaceutical companies. And then there's the more collaborative nonprofit approach that really brings people together and solves this crisis as fast as possible in a collaborative way that brings government, corporations, and NGOs together at the same table. And early on, pharmaceutical companies were fighting this more collaborative approach kind of tooth and nail.
From the very beginning, there were plans to capitalize on the desperate need for medicines, for vaccines, for test kits, for protective gear.
You know, we reported very early on banks pressuring healthcare distributors, healthcare companies to raise prices on ventilators, on masks, on other kinds of therapeutics used to treat people infected with this virus.
So we saw members of the House begin to try to guard against this a year ago, February, so February 2020. Jan Schakowsky, who's a Democrat in the House.
Last week, 45 of my colleagues and I sent a letter to President Trump. And what we were talking about is, are we going to be guaranteed an affordable treatments or vaccines that are developed? We're concerned that private pharmaceutical companies may end up having a role in this and raising the cost beyond the point that people could well afford it.
We absolutely share your passion around ensuring affordable access to medicines, but the private sector must have a role in this. We will not have a vaccine, we will not have therapeutics without the private sector candidates that they and we will have to invest in.
We have paid for
that request was opposed by many Republicans who actually opposed adding language to a House bill that, you know, would have made sure that there wasn't obscene profiting. And the final aid package, the coronavirus aid package that was passed, did leave out that language.
Today, we're joining 37 countries and numerous partners to launch the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool, or CTAP. CTAP was first proposed by His Excellency President Carlos Alvarado of Costa Rica.
Last year, the president of Costa Rica proposed a special idea and technology and patent sharing initiative so that, you know, leading companies and scientists could all pitch in and share the latest vaccine and therapeutic technologies and research. So as a global society, we could come up with the most efficient ways to treat this disease.
Gracias, Dr. Tedros.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros, my brother. In recent weeks, this joint effort has helped us to put together this
call for solidarity and action to give us a platform so we can share openly on a voluntary basis and in a collaborative way the data and the intellectual property that will be generated throughout the world in order to make it a public global good.
And as soon as that was proposed, a body that represents the international pharmaceutical industry, a lobbying body, immediately held a press conference and hosted the CEOs of major pharmaceutical companies and really blasted this proposal, at least implicitly, saying that, you know, any effort to share this technology was, quote, nonsense and dangerous. That's the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bulla.
Yes, I want to say that I'm very respectful of the opinions of many people, of everyone. And as such, I think I'm hearing all the people that are speaking about IP. But I have to say that at this point of time, it's nonsense. And at this point of time, it's also dangerous.
The CEO of AstraZeneca similarly attacked this effort and said,
I think IP is a fundamental part of our industry. And if you don't protect IP, then essentially there's no incentive for anybody to innovate. Now, what is important is that companies volunteer to provide their products at no profit like we are doing right now in case of pandemic or crisis and when it's needed.
So from a very early stage of this pandemic, there's been a push and pull, a push by investors and CEOs of healthcare companies, healthcare distributors, pharmaceutical companies to maximize profit during the course of this pandemic, and a pushback from countries and NGOs, activists, and politicians to say, look, this unprecedented crisis requires an unprecedented level of collaboration and not this kind of typical profit seeking we've seen in the healthcare sector.
The companies that are lobbying for this, we already know that Pfizer, who Lee just talked about, are on track to, I believe, make $24 billion in profits 2021 from the vaccine. And then you look at Moderna, which was almost entirely funded by the U.S. government, and they're also on track to make huge, I believe it's around $18 billion this year.
It is with the dedication of these noble buildings to the service of man that we are assembled here today. The National Institute of Health speaks the universal language of humanitarianism.
When a product gets made, there are lots of stages of development, and often at the very early stages and sometimes throughout its development, that science is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And, you know, government funding is a big spark for research. And so all the vaccines have some U.S.-funded science in them.
Taxpayers have provided nearly $10 billion to Operation Warp Speed, but have no knowledge of how these resources are being spent. For the companies receiving taxpayer funding for your vaccines, have any of your contracts or agreements with the federal government included provisions to ensure affordability in pricing or vaccines, affordable pricing of vaccines or treatments? Let me start again with Dr. Ho about the agreements. What's in them?
No, they don't. We don't have a supply agreement with the U.S. government, Congressman. We have a research and development agreement.
Even though we pay for this development and some, you know, either it's a portion or all of it, the American taxpayers don't go on to own the product or hold the patent to the product. What the U.S. does is fund it, and then the companies often go on to have these exclusive ownership with patents.
That publicly funded science, through a law called the Bayh-Dole Act, is then transferred to pharmaceutical companies.
The act establishes the rules of the road governing patent or patent rights when the federal government and private entities participate in joint research that produces patentable inventions.
This law basically codified this rapid transfer of publicly funded technology, publicly funded science into commercial monopoly rights for private industry. And, you know, one kind of fail-safe for this law so it doesn't get exploited by private industry was this provision basically allowing margin rights, is what they're known, basically saying if a company is exploiting a pharmaceutical product that was financed by the taxpayer, the government has a right to march in and then revoke that license and then issue it to a competitor, you know, allow, you know, another firm to use that technology, create a generic or a competing product. One kind of wrinkle here is that the pharmaceutical companies have really pushed back against any effort to use margin rights to kind of invoke this provision of the Bayh-Dole Act. And in a twilight kind of maneuver, as the Trump administration was leaving office in early January 2021, they issued a new rule basically revoking and redefining that one provision of the Bayh-Dole Act, allowing the government to march in and set prices. So this was a kind of a goodbye, farewell, wet kiss from the Trump administration to the pharmaceutical industry.
Pharmaceutical companies defend their right to profit and to fend off margin rights, and also the use of another provision under the law, Section 1498, which is similar, allows the government to take over in these kinds of cases. And what they say is that they need exclusivity because that's how they innovate, right? That it wouldn't, you know, that they're not going to do this critical life-saving work unless they can profit from it and reap the benefits.
You know, what's interesting about this debate is that what the pharmaceutical industry has always argued is that they're doing the research and development. They're putting up the risk, so to speak, you know, raising money from investors. So of course they should have monopoly rights on the price and the distribution of these drugs so they can reap a profit and then pay back their investors after taking this risk. But what's interesting about Operation Warp Speed, this program approved by Congress and, you know, initially managed by the Trump administration, awarding something like 10, and then they increased it to something like $18 billion of money to fund the development of therapeutics and vaccines and to expedite that process to solve the pandemic, is that here's the taxpayer taking all the risk and providing the public money for the research, the development, the clinical trials, even the pre-purchases of these vaccines.
Its objective is to finish developing and then to manufacture and distribute a proven coronavirus vaccine as fast as possible. Again, we'd love
the pharmaceutical industry, despite, you know, not having to do the type of risk taking that typical business people or, you know, corporations have to do, they're saying that they still deserve those monopoly rights on the pricing, the distribution of this product that was guaranteed by the taxpayer, by the U.S. Treasury. Maybe we could be solving, you know, cancer or, you know, other kind of public health issues by just having many Operation Warp Speeds, just putting up the public money, taking the public risk, and then solving these problems, and perhaps maybe adjusting the rights then given to the pharmaceutical companies, forcing these medicines to be at lower price and more public access.
Right after the announcement came, AOC had this great tweet that was a screenshot of the falling vaccine maker prices and stock prices, and it said, let's do insulin next. There is no difference in the ethics, right? It is equally horrific that companies are using their exclusive protections to set exorbitant prices for other life-saving drugs. I think we need to remember what happens with those exorbitant profits, right? So some of it goes into executive compensation and bonuses and to stock dividends. But some of it goes right back into lobbying, right? And the pharmaceutical industry spends more on lobbying than any other sector. And that lobbying is used to perpetuate this very system. The exclusivity of drugs, which is what they're fighting for, right? These exclusive protections is inextricable from the obscene prices. And it is inextricable from the fact that these drugs don't get to the people that need them. This is a problem that needs to be addressed not just right now and not just temporarily, which is how the TRIPS waiver does it, but in the longer term. It's also a problem for people to die from treatable conditions or preventable conditions when it's not COVID.
You know, going into the pandemic, pre-pandemic in 2019, opinion polls pretty consistently showed that the pharmaceutical industry was the most unpopular industry in America, ranking below the oil industry, below automakers, you know, below some of these other companies that have been criticized in the past. And this pandemic has been used by lobbyists representing the industry to really reposition the industry as, you know, this global leader that cares about human health, that is not putting profits first, it's putting the people first. If you turn on CNN or MSNBC, you see these reputation ads. They don't actually sell a product, but they're sponsored by the industry and their lobbyists to try to increase public opinion and discourage further regulation. You know, they've got people in lab coats, you know, pouring beakers and vials on conveyor belts. They say, oh, look, the pharmaceutical industry is doing everything they can to fight this pandemic. We care about the American people.
While you do your part to beat coronavirus, America's biopharmaceutical companies are working around the clock to do ours, testing existing medicines, developing new treatments and vaccines, and collaborating with the FDA, NIH, and CDC. We're working with doctors and hospitals on over 235 clinical trials and ramping up production capabilities to ensure these medicines are available, because science is how we get back to normal.
They're really utilizing this pandemic to reposition themselves as totally concerned about public health, and they're not an industry that puts profit over people. Meanwhile, behind closed doors, the pharmaceutical industry has mobilized an army of lobbyists, poured massive amounts of dark money into the last election to ensure that they can really capitalize on this pandemic and make the most money possible. And early in the Biden administration, we saw a little peek of this. The U.S. Trade Representative, that's the kind of sub-cabinet or cabinet-level position that represents the American government in these trade negotiations, the pharmaceutical industry and its allies submitted comments basically to this office saying, hey, Biden administration, when you set your trade priorities for the year, what you should do is not only oppose any effort to provide a waiver for IP or patent enforcement around vaccines or therapeutics to solve the crisis. In fact, you should actually punish any country that produces a generic, that you should go out and provide trade-related sanctions and go after countries.
We have had more than 3 million deaths already from COVID around the world. And here in the US, we already have more than enough vaccine, right? Anyone who's an adult can already get it if they want it. And so far, more than half of the US population has had at least one dose of the vaccine. But around the world, it's totally different. Less than 1% of the populations of low-income countries have been vaccinated. What I think has been compelling to many people in the US and in the pharmaceutical industry is that that's not just not viable for those people, but it's also ultimately going to come back and bite wealthier countries in the butt too, because that's how variants are going to come back. That's, none of us are going to be safe until all of us are safe. And you see that as the pandemic is allowed to go on, people are going to die in huge numbers in developing countries, but it's also going to mean that the pandemic keeps going everywhere.
What's undergirding all of this policymaking, all this debate around the waiver, is the potential for massive profits. The pharmaceutical companies, despite, again, their public posture of you know, donating vaccines and working to save the world, you know, privately with their investors have been incredibly clear about how they plan to hike prices when the opportunity presents itself. If you listen to these recent investor calls from Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, Pfizer, they've spoken to you know, banks and other investors and said they're hoping to make lots of money from these vaccines.
If you look at how current demand and current pricing is being driven, it's clearly not being driven by what I'll call normal market conditions, normal market forces. It's really been driven by kind of the pandemic state that we've been in and the needs of governments to really secure doses from the various vaccine suppliers. So what we believe, what I believe is we move from a pandemic state, from a pandemic situation to an endemic situation, normal market forces, normal market conditions will start to kick in.
Right now, they're selling the vaccine, at least in the US, at a deeply discounted price. They're concerned about the optics around increasing the price, but when the time comes, they plan to dramatically commercialize this product. And right now, many of the vaccines are sold, you know, reimbursed by the government, but sold between $20 and $40. That's much lower than the list price of, for example, the flu vaccine, which is closer to $170 or $200. Even with the deeply discounted prices, Pfizer is taking their vaccine and basically made it one of the highest grossing pharmaceutical products of all time. I mean, as Sharon mentioned earlier, they're making record profits from the vaccine, and that's at the lower price. The pharmaceutical companies, in addition, have said they plan to increase prices once the pandemic, quote unquote, ends. But as Johnson & Johnson told investors recently, they get to determine the end of the pandemic. They get to just simply unilaterally declare the pandemic over and increase prices. AstraZeneca, a similar situation. There were leaked documents showing that, you know, AstraZeneca has promised to sell the vaccine at a not-for-profit basis during the pandemic, but these leaked documents show that they get to declare the end of the pandemic as early as July 1st of this year. So these companies are eagerly awaiting the opportunity to increase prices. They are fighting every effort to allow competitors to open, to enter the field, you know, the production of generic vaccines, and that's why they're fighting this TRIPS waiver.
We easily could have seen Biden go another way. And I think a lot of people expected that. That said, it's this incremental step, right? So we see that we've committed to waiving intellectual property protections for vaccines in a temporary way, right? Beyond that, we're going to need investment.
There needs to be an effort to increase capacity, to share technology, to share manufacturing know-how so that generic vaccines are produced very quickly. I mean, there's some talk that these mRNA vaccines could be produced and factories could be retrofitted very quickly to produce them. And we need kind of global leadership, whether it's Biden or others leaning on these companies or Congress passing new laws that compel them to share the manufacturing know-how.
So I think it's the time to ramp up pressure. And it's such an opportunity for the world and for the U.S. to do good. It's a rare opportunity, right? This is actually a really solvable problem, making enough vaccine. We know how to do it now, and we have the money, right? So now we just have to do it. Yes, there are wrinkles to be figured out, and we're ironing them out. But let's go, you know? Here we go.
That's The Intercept's investigative journalists Sharon Lerner and Lee Fong. And that does it for this episode of Intercepted. You can follow us on Twitter at Intercepted and on Instagram at Intercepted Podcast. Intercepted is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our lead producer is Jack Desidero. Supervising producer is me, Laura Flynn. Betsy Reed is editor-in-chief of The Intercept. Rick Kwan mixed our show. Our theme music, as always, was composed by DJ Spooky. Until next time.
Couple of things. You heard the pharmaceutical guy talking about endemic as opposed to epidemic. Well, by not rapidly inoculating most of the world and letting variants happen, you're ensuring that it's endemic and that there'll be a need for further injections. So I don't know if that's a calculation they're making consciously or not. The other thing is that brilliant put together, but one thing that isn't mentioned in the critique of Big Pharma as it currently exists, that the not only is Dole by not ensuring that stuff comes to market, that the pharmaceutical industry and the medical equipment industry is buying things, killer acquisitions, buying stuff that's competitive, maybe better, and killing it to ensure their profits. Beyond disgust, one more segment on this. And where is it? Walden Bellow. I mentioned I met him on campus some time ago. We'll just have enough time before the labor hour. They are going to talk about the situation on the ground in Israel-Palestine a bit. I shared some material with Gus about this Republican-sponsored bill, though. Oh, well, I'll let him get to it. Stay around for that in the next couple of hours after we hear Walden Bellow with Sonali Kalhatkar. Further talking about the world situation with the pandemic and the pharmaceuticals.
Host Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. President Joe Biden, after months of pressure from advocacy groups and developing nation governments, announced that he supports the waiving of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines. The governments of India and South Africa last October requested that the 1995 TRIPS agreement at the World Trade Organization be suspended for the vaccines so countries can begin mass producing them. TRIPS stands for the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. While Moderna has announced it would not enforce its patent, other pharmaceutical producers of COVID vaccines, such as AstraZeneca and Pfizer, have vehemently opposed waiving intellectual property rights, even though taxpayers shelled out much of the investment into developing the vaccines. The issue has taken on great urgency as the virus spreads like wildfire across India and other Asian nations. Opponents of waiving the rights claim that the developing world simply does not have access to the expertise, raw materials, or factories needed to mass-produce vaccines on their own. Today, we'll speak with one expert who's pushing back against such arguments. Walden Bellow is an international adjunct professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Binghamton and co-chairperson of the Bangkok-based Research and Advocacy Institute Focus on the Global South. He's the author or co-author of 25 books, including Counter-Revolution, The Global Rise of the Far Right, and the winner of the Right Livelihood Award for his work on corporate-driven globalization. He just published a guest opinion column in the New York Times on May 5th entitled, "The West Has Been Hoarding More Than Vaccines." He now joins me from Manila in the Philippines. Welcome to the program, Walden Bellow.
Thank you for inviting me, Sonali.
So first, let's start with the arguments that we're hearing from the pharmaceutical industry and its allies about the dangers of waiving these intellectual property rights for COVID vaccines. There's numerous arguments. One of the arguments that they're giving is that it's not really the intellectual property rights that are standing in the way, because Moderna has already said that it wouldn't enforce its intellectual property rights, and no other company has actually begun manufacturing Moderna vaccines. The real issue is that there are supplies that are limited and supply chains are difficult and there aren't enough factories and quality control is something that we can't rely on, et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, I think these arguments are really quite spurious. In terms of Moderna saying it's not going to quarrel with intellectual property rights if other people obtain them, that's no assurance that it would not do so, because there are these trade-related intellectual property rights which are quite strict. And just because Moderna says that it's not going to fight it, if others use its patents and its processes, that's no guarantee. That's why nobody touches these things unless there is an official government waiver. And Moderna knows that, okay? And Pfizer knows that. And all of these people know that, that any move by a developing country, manufacturer, to touch patents without a waiver is going to bring the whole legal system of international law under TRIPS down on them. And that's why even after patents have lapsed after 20 years, unless there are really specific waivers or guarantees, which are guaranteed by governments, there's a great deal of hesitation because of the power of this company. So that's one. The second thing is, it's not at all true, you know, that supplies, raw materials and processes are going to be really complicated. In fact, what the South Africa and India waiver proposals is that it's not only patents, but diagnostics, treatment, and technological processes that would, in fact, be lifted.
That's what those two countries are asking for at the WTO. They don't just want the patents, they want the processes.
Yeah, processes, and, you know, so that's the... So that's also a spurious argument, you know, that's going on there. And there are this vaccination manufacturing facilities in Brazil, Thailand, and India that have tremendous capacity so long as these processes get to them. This supply chain, lack of raw materials, you know, this repurposing is going to be very difficult for vaccination facilities. I think that's just been disproven by, you know, in the course of the debate over the last 8 months. So if these people had not been standing in the way since last October, we would not have this supply problem right now. You know, so basically they're saying that, hey, you know, you can't solve the supply problem, when in fact they have created the supply problem by refusing to budge on this issue for the last 8 months. So we're losing time.
What about India? You brought up India, which is right now the epicenter of the crisis, the global pandemic crisis. India has its own vaccine, Covaxin, and then it's also producing the AstraZeneca vaccine known as Covishield. So why does India need the property rights to be waived on vaccines when it has its own homegrown vaccine and is already partnering to produce the AstraZeneca vaccine?
You've got to realize that those are only two vaccine manufacturing companies, okay? But there are other, you know, quite a number of other vaccine manufacturers in India that are producing other vaccines and not the COVID-19 vaccine. So repurposing those other manufacturers, you know, is going to bring about a lot to resolve the supply problem. There are about 10 to 15 other big manufacturers over there. It's a question of repurposing their vaccine facilities to COVID-19 vaccines. Then there's Thailand, then there's South Africa, then there's Brazil, and there are a number of other countries that have already set up their pharmaceutical infrastructure over the last two decades. So it's not at all a valid argument. It will take a couple of weeks, if not, you know, maybe a month or 2 months or what. But you've got to start because you're running against time. More and more people are not going to have access to vaccines over the next several months. So you have to start right now. The industry people are just creating all of this nonsense in order to hold on to their cash cows, which are the patents and the processes of manufacturing that are tied up with them.
Right. I mean, the companies are saying that that it will stifle future innovation to share patents. But of course, they fail to mention the fact that the tax dollars, billions and billions of tax dollars from the residents of Western nations like the U.S. have been poured into creating these vaccines. And any future emergency where we desperately need vaccines would have a similar investment. So that question of innovation seems certainly a moot point.
It's not only because $12 billion has been invested in them by, you know, the citizens of countries in the North. The problem is that they make this argument that it's going to stifle innovation. Now, if you look at all of those drug companies, where is more of the money going? Most of the money is going to marketing. It's not going to innovation. It's going to marketing, okay, and to executive pay. The proportion of their revenues going to innovation is quite small at this point in time, because what they actually do is they have a monopoly on a certain product, and they over 20 years that they have guaranteed monopoly on that, that's where they promote, they really push marketing. That's where the money goes. Burla, the Albert Burla, the head CEO of Pfizer, he makes something like about $21.4 million in a pay compensation a year, including salaries and stock options. Pascal Soriot of Seneca, making the same amounts. You have Albert Gorski of Johnson & Johnson, making the same, very much of the same amounts of around 21 to 22, 23 million. So, and they've got highly paid executive staff. So basically, these are the people, multimillionaires, the 1% in the world, who are making, raking it in because of the monopoly on drugs, drug production, that are really the big problems. It's just like the illegal drugs cartel, you know, except this one, they monopolize intellectual property rights. I think we really need to show the real face of these guys. These are robber barons, okay? And I think the world should not stand for it. And I'm glad that the Biden administration decided to go against these members of the 1% that are
right. And I want to get to Biden's position in just a moment, but I do want to bring up another one of the arguments from the pharmaceutical companies, and that is one of trust. Now, some have said that this is a very condescending argument to suggest that companies producing vaccines in the global south might not get it right. But we've seen that even with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and even the AstraZeneca vaccine, that even a very, very rare case of blood clots among women of a certain age has reduced the trust, the public trust in these vaccines so much that a majority of people now don't trust them. Do you think it's valid, this argument that that if they share the patents, that there might be counterfeits on the market that could reduce trust in vaccines?
I really think that's just a red herring that they're setting up there. I mean, and it's, as you said, it's a condescending argument, you know, that if you give an Indian manufacturer, Brazilian manufacturer, who have been already flagged through the licensing processes within their own countries, that those people are going to somehow screw up in the manufacturing. I mean, this is all speculative, and it's against the record in which many of these manufacturers have been producing generics for years, and they've succeeded in fact producing stuff that's as good, if not better, than the original brands. It's one of these arguments that they throw up because they're so desperate. Like, they even say that the whole thing, the messenger RNA has bioweapons potential, and yet that's been discredited as an argument. In fact, you know, the viral vector and the traditional way of making vaccines has more biosecurity potential than the messenger RNA. A lot of studies have already, in fact, shown that. So they have such a cash cow going for them. Pfizer is going to be making $15 billion this year, okay? Even just in sales in the northern countries. So it's sheer greed.
So let's talk about the Biden administration. Many people were heartened and were comparing the waiving of intellectual property rights on COVID-19 vaccines to what happened two decades ago with the HIV medication that the U.S. administration at that time refused to waive the patents for. Now, Europe is standing in the way. So is the U.K. They're refusing to join Biden in agreeing to waive the intellectual property rights. And the WTO process, I understand, is a consensus process. So it does require everyone to be on board. Can Biden's position influence Europe and the U.K.?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of it is going to be moral pressure coming from their citizens. I think if you look at the way that legislatures, Europarliamentarians, notable scientists have been stepping forward to say, let's support the waiver, I think citizen pressure is going to count in this instance. And how long the EU and the UK stand in the way are going to be determined by citizen pressure. But let's face it, the WTO operates by consensus. But if there is no consensus that can be reached, there is the fallback position of 75% of the members of the WTO can override, can in fact push through an initiative.
So they can vote if there's 75% support.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If it has 75% support, it can push through. Of course, the ideal is consensus, and they try to maintain that. But to a large extent, if the developing countries, if the 100 sponsors and the United States really, really push it, and I think they can override the opposition if it comes to a vote. But as I say, the ideal is consensus, and I think that's what they're still trying to do at this point. The moral pressure coming from the citizens of the North, of the EU and others, is going to be very central in this case.
And Pope Francis has already come out and said he supports Biden in his position on the waiver, so there's certainly a moral authority there. Well,
yes.
Weldon Bello, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much. And we'll post a link to your op-ed in the New York Times from our website.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Weldon Bello, International Adjunct Professor of Sociology at the State University of New York at Binghamton and co-chairperson of Focus on the Global South. His recent op-ed in the New York Times was entitled, "The West Has Been Hoarding More Than Vaccines." He was speaking to me from Manila in the Philippines. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
You know, the only postscript I have in the last seconds here is that the U.S. does not have to wait for the TRIPS. It can use the Birch Dole-Birch-Dole-By Act that is the act that actually privatized all the research and all the wealth and the patents and the research done in NIH and in academic places. They can license or enjoin a licensing agreement, and they could use the Defense Production Act to ramp up production of the materials needed for the vaccination around the world. All right, that's opinions of those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station, and I'm confused here. There we go.